Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. I'm your co-host, Andy Fitzell, alongside Steve Smith. And in this episode is part two of our Tennis in Russia series.
Russians in tennis.
Russians in tennis, tennis in Russia. And we have a special guest in the house, our good friend, coach, parent, tennis parent, Natalia Sorokina.
Hi, guys. Hello. Coach
thanks.
Andy.
Well,
Coach
Steve. Thanks for being here.
It's a big privilege to be here.
You're here for a few weeks with your daughter, Taisia, training with us.
Yes, it's been great so far.
One more week to go. Oh, it's been great having you. Lots of fun out on the field.
Yes. Fitness.
Fitness and
character,
running.
Character. Toughness.
Yeah. All the things we're going to talk about, tennis in Russia.
Let's start a little bit with your background. We talked a little bit last week about Daniel Coyle's well-known article, the book, The Talent Code, but also... Yeah. Making of a super athlete. Tell us about your childhood in tennis in Russia.
So I started playing tennis when I was around nine. So before I was doing ice skating. So I was very good at ice skating. And at 10, I switched on tennis full time. So I train. I'm from Moscow. So I train in one place. First year, it was whatever was available. What my mom could find the place. So my family doesn't have any sports background. So, and then when I was 10 and a half, so I started going to Spartak, famous Spartak school.
Yeah.
Back in there, like looking back, so it was nothing special. Just same, old buildings, winter, long winters, and you had to go to school and tennis and... looking back, so it was probably a great experience. And I spent there a few years, and then I joined a program outside of Moscow. There was first program in Russia sponsored by Russian government and Terpishev, who was head of Russia Tennis Federation. Mm-hmm. So the outside, like 60 miles away from Moscow, so it was a small city called Stupina. And my coach was older guy, and it was very unique. We had some boarding students, and in first year, I would finish Friday school and go and train for a weekend training there.
Was that after Spartak or before?
Yes, it was after Spartak. So it's kind of a few kids that had opportunities. They left Spartak and a couple of other schools to join this program.
Yeah.
So they were older, so I was kind of, I was 13 when I joined the program.
Yeah, so going back to Spartak, because, you know, Talent Code is definitely one of my favorite books. I love reading about Daniel Coyle's experience there in Russia at the Spartak Club. And one of the things he talks about is, you know, going up, same thing you just said, kind of old buildings, you know, but shadow swinging and that the players would not, you know, hit a ball. We talked about this a little bit last week until they had at least 3 years of training. But tell us a little bit about your experience at Spartak and maybe like a, what was a day-to-day like there?
So you would come for a couple of hours. Depends on your age and your level. I would say in the winter there would be 2 hours, 3 times a week. And you do different exercises, a lot of shadow swinging, a lot of running. So Spartak is in the woods, so it's a big park. Mm. It's pretty central Moscow, so but it's still woods around. So we would run, we would do different fitness and shadow swings. And in the winter, it was always cold inside the building, so there's like not very fancy. So we had to put a lot of clothes and we just would do... what coach would yell at us. So it was always yelling. So that's why it's kind of transferring, like, okay, yell.
Yeah. Now the kids love it to be pushed. With the shadow swinging, I'm just curious about, did they break things down? I know that, you know, we'll get into checkpoints and things like that, but do they break things down into checkpoints?
Not really. So it was more, you had to just move your feet and do shadow. So nothing really, like no very specific technically.
Yeah.
Though the grips were on the forehands and backhand side. They would put you on the right grip. Okay, this is how you hold your racket. Okay, here we go. So probably they would never address it again after first year.
Getting into Anything real specific technically?
No. Like serve all is no much information. We didn't have any access for.
But that. Lots and lots of movement.
Yes.
And how many kids were typical in the program at one time?
It depends. They would bring you, it could be 10 kids on the court. Sometimes it would be a group of 4 kids on the court. So they would break it down. Some kids would do one thing, another group would do another exercise. So,
and it was just one court, right, indoor in the wintertime?
Yeah, so actually there were 2 courts, but they were like in a little bit different located. Yeah, and outdoors there were 16 courts.
Yeah,
16 courts. So we had to appreciate the summertime.
Yeah, I do think that people, like say, would consider America, well, there's American system of teaching or the Czech system of teaching or Australian system. But we've asked you this before. There really wasn't necessarily a Russian system.
No, Russian system didn't exist. Tennis was not popular before in Soviet Union, so it was not Olympic sport before 1980, and so there was no system of no technical, but it was tough, always character, fitness,
yeah,
and just tough culture.
You know, quite a few of the players that came out of Spartak, certainly they found their way to other places of the world to train, like Kornikova, Safin. But the serve was always questioned with some of the players. But actually, in this country, one of the reasons that players served so well was baseball. You know, everyone could throw baseball, and even way back when sport wasn't fair for girls, if a girl played sports back in the day, way back, she was considered a tomboy. But everybody could throw. I always share the story about World War II, where the American soldiers were throwing grenades. And the German soldiers were putting a grenade on an 8-inch rod, and they were going like this, and sometimes they'd come this way, and whoops, the grenade went the wrong way. But I've been in Moscow many times, and girls, I can't say I've seen a lot of boys do this, but they come to the court before their lesson, and they get in the corner, and they just shadow swing like a boxer. But it was a big emphasis on winning, because it was always so much baseline tennis play. It wasn't a matter of going forward and playing all over the court.
No, there was no specific training. So when I was 13, my coach, I was not good at the net, and 14, sorry. My coach would put me at the net. Okay, you're going to learn how to volley and bound the balls, like 100 balls. And I was covered with
black and blue marks.
Yes, yes. So that was okay. You have to just react. And
were your parents, or were there many parents around watching?
No, not really.
They
parents, no,
the
parents, they would usually, they would not really kind of allowed to come in, and even talking to the coaches back in the day, there was no such a thing. And tournaments, you go with coach. So
you just do what you're told. You get in there and work.
Yes. It's not just, okay, I have a question for the coach. Like these days, the parent would come out like every time and ask you. No, so my parents, they were far away from tennis.
Yeah.
What do you think formed the culture? Was it rules? Was it passion? Was it a combination of things?
I think it was a combination of culture, some success, like some players. And when in my generation, like Kournikova, so when she was so successful, and a lot of people, they looked up to her, a lot of parents, they wanted the same for their daughters. So that's success.
Yeah.
And Kournikova brought a lot of charisma in women's tennis. And in Russia, everyone was obsessed with her and how pretty she was and on the court. And
the braids. And
yes.
So beautiful. I wrote this in my notes. I always stand up and shout when people say that she wasn't a very good player. She was number 8 in the world in singles. Number 1 in doubles. She was in 2 mixed finals, 2 doubles titles, talking Grand Slams. She reached a 4th round or better of every Grand Slam. I think 99.9% of players would die for that record.
Yeah.
So
now she was.
But she was certainly known for her beauty.
Yeah, but her family was very dedicated. Her mom was next to her for a long period of time, and think that also is kind of a key to success.
I think, you know, they found their way to Nick Bollettieri's, and forever it's been said about Bollettieri's, you know, toughest playground in tennis, but there was no such thing as a practice match. In other words, you didn't go out and, well, I'm going to work on serving volley or taking second serves coming in. It's like, no, go play the match and win the match. Yeah.
It's like Russian mentality as well. So it's whenever you play, you play. So there's no such a thing, okay, I'm going to practice set, okay, and then I go. So it's just you play to win.
Yeah. Well, you know, certainly we're on the side of over-teaching, but I do think under-teaching, you need to find the right balance. When it comes down to will beats skill, but if will has skill, will and skill together triumphs.
Yes, like current generation, Rublev is from Spartak, so and Rublev's mom, she's a coach at Spartak, and she was my first coach in the group lessons that I started to attend in Spartak. She's still young, like maybe early 50s. Marina.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I was around him for, I was at two tournaments with my son Connor that he was playing when he was maybe 17, 18. Yeah, the eyes of a competitor. I've got down here Dementieva and Kornikova, both the same age. And they were both players that, were very successful.
Miskina was too, same age. Three of them.
Okay. But I wasn't really thinking so much of her. She won the French, correct? But they all struggled on the serve.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's one something that I stand up for Nick, too. A lot of people who've never had anything to do with Nick Bollettieri. He's in the International Hall of Fame for a reason, but he did it through creating an environment. Like, say, Braden is in the International Tennis Hall of Fame because of education. But, you know, hats off to be able to create that culture with differences between, say, you know, and there's so many, you know, we say tennis in Russia, but Russians in tennis. What do you think some of the differences are between junior tennis here in the U.S., junior tennis in Russia?
It's hard to compare because probably now things changed, but I can compare to years, let's say 20 years ago when I played. So it's definitely different. So it's, first of all, when you play tennis in Russia, when you're junior player, so you play and you have no choices than going to play pro. So you have no perspective going high school tennis. There's no such a thing. Tennis is not a school sport. Then you have no college sports there in Russia. So the only goal you go for is playing pro tennis. Mm. So it's a different mentality. So you have to survive. So it's not just playing toys or country club. These days, what I've been observing so far in America, like different places, I've been in different places and different clubs. So kids are more like, it's more country club sport here, so everyone was comfortable. And if you tell something negative or truth in most of the kids, they don't like it, that you can be fired, so you can be in trouble as a coach.
So then if a kid, let's say you're 6 years old in Russia and you're like, okay, I want to try out tennis or go play tennis. At first, is it, hey, let me go see if I kind of like this? Or is it like, hey, let's go over there, you're going to be a pro?
Again, back in the day, it was, okay, if you get to that system where you have Zushore or Sushore, which is like a school, junior school of Olympic sport. So when you get to the school, you're on the path, they consider you to be on the path Olympic athlete. Mm. So there is no question. So
that's, how young does that start? I mean,
that depends on the sport. Probably 7 in tennis. 7, but now it's of course a lot of like private academies and everyone wants make money. So I know a lot of new places open in Moscow, and other big cities in Russia. So it's everything changed a lot. And but it's still, if you get to that Zushore school, you get a lot of free. You're going that there's a system. So if you have it's in every sport, you have a kind of a rage. So like a sport rage. So you go junior, like three is the bottom, then two and one is the top in junior. And when you, and then you can go to adult. Again, it's, and then it's, it goes three, two, one, and then eventually like master of sport. And you get a lot of, when you get to that adult as a junior, you get a lot of stuff for free, even these days. So it's like travel, tournaments, entries. And so it's a big advantage.
So the whole kind of country club sort of activity, tennis is an activity, does that, these days, does that exist in Russia or is it still?
Yes, there are new academies for sure. So it depends on the programs. Like in new academies, they have for all like recreational players and more serious. But they still have those dushors where you go and it's for athletes. You know, this is oriented. That specific.
So if you're going to go there, it's like, hey, you're going.
Yes.
You're going all the way.
With last week we touched upon, you know, my background indirectly through my brother. He was over there many times. I was there later, but through ice hockey, but how everyone started with gymnastics. And I mentioned I've been to many, many tennis facilities. We're going to do that here with our construction of our small facility, is have an area really for outdoor gymnastics. Or body balance exercises. Did you start that when you were a kid?
I started with ice skating. So it's gymnastics or ice skating. Ice skating is very popular. Every neighborhood we have rinks, and all kids, they do ice skating or hockey. Gymnastics is popular too. And it's not just regular gymnastics. The girls, they go to rhythmic gymnastics. So it's a very popular thing for younger girls to do. Or ballet class. But definitely ice skating and gymnastics, they're the most popular. And all kids, they do something when they're younger, and it's not within your school, so it's always extra. So within school, you barely have some like sports. Same with music, so you have to go to music school.
But I think that's where, my experience is being around Russian tennis players, or being in Russia, that it's still a sport. We're here, as Andy used the word, activity, that it's not so social. Obviously, being at tennis facilities, I know very wealthy people will play, you know, where it's just recreational tennis, but it just seems where, you know, even though the government has changed, where we've, you know, Winston Churchill, you know, democracy is not perfect, or capitalism is not perfect. When it comes down to communism, you know, you mentioned 20 years ago for junior tennis. I was in Red Square in 87, and then over 20 years later, it was in Red Square. So it was like total control in 87, and then it was a little bit out of control in 87. And we're going for a midnight jog and being a group of soldiers in a Jeep came after me and said, "What are you doing?" in Russian.
Just going for a jog.
Going for a jog. But with, so I know times have changed, but in this country, or I think in the West, we've catered to the wealthy. Where years ago, you know, Soviet sport was catering to the talented. Does that still exist? Or is it just now, is now it become more of a sport for wealthy people?
No, it's still this. I believe that sport still exists, and some sports are, obviously, they will be always popular, like soccer or hockey. But tennis is still exists in a way. Still, a lot of those older coaches, women's coaches, and the culture is tough. So it's going.
Yeah, what is, you know, discipline? I know you've used that word before. How does that come into play as far as, is that part of culture? Or is that just like, hey, with sport in general in Russia, is it more just, okay, everybody's pretty disciplined in what they're doing? How's that attitude?
I wouldn't say it's connected really with country. It's more about sports. So if you do sports, it's like army. And like in Soviet Union, it's just, you have to do this. If you have to get up 6 o'clock, and you always get up 6 o'clock. For me, it was a very big surprise when I came to America. Okay, camps, they start, tennis camps, they start at 9 o'clock. The earliest in America, and like swimming practices, swimming camps, they start like 6 in the morning. How come? I'm used to be like with 7 o'clock, we're already running on our camps, and when we went south to train. So it's like, so that's kind of a discipline. So you just, you dedicate, you do what coach tells you, and just discipline. So it's never miss, never quit.
I think in this country, less and less is the coach the coach. I tell people, well, I think I'm, you know, 37% the coach. But I remember living in Texas in the 80s, and the Texas culture, whether it was from, you know, families being together through religion or football, it was just the South. It was a yes sir, no sir society. But I think back in the 80s, it was like, okay, I'm truly the coach. Lou Holtz, the football coach, says that, where today kids are asking, what are my rights and privileges? But before, they were asking, what are my obligations and responsibilities? Is that is that something that's different, you think, with Russian coaching, that the coach is more the boss, the coach is more
Yes, coaches, you never question the coach, so it's obviously it's not a question, so never was an issue.
Has that style changed at all? Like, you know, people might say a command style coach versus maybe a cooperative coach.
I don't know about the younger guys, but older ones, they still pretty strict, pretty disciplined.
Yeah.
There are a lot of women's coaches. So when I played, so I had a lot of women's coaches around me, but my head coach was at a certain point older man, Epstein, and it was great. I would say he was nice. He was nicer than those ladies. And my one of the ladies who ran fitness program with us, she was terrible, like so strict. So we had no excuse to get out of there. Like,
what would be an example of her being so strict about? I mean, what kind of?
No, just you go work on fitness and okay, on tennis court, the drill. Just you knew you had to do that, so you would be screamed, and it was always. It was more not humiliating factor. No, it was just, okay, you're going to do it. So that's it. So you couldn't really show your weakness. So they would never say, oh, you're weak, because it was not common. So we considered not to be weak people.
Yeah. So. Well, even today, with Taisia, she was outside and you guys ran, 12 400s, right?
Yeah.
12 times around, and I was going to shoot something, and I was like, oh, you know, maybe need a couple of people to run. And she was, oh, you know, I'm kind of tired. She went over, and then you were like, no, you're going to do it. You're going to go. You can go right now. Yeah. I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's like actually a good example. Yeah. So they would be like, okay, no, you're going to do it. Like, no way you escape from here. It's like, no way you quit now.
Yeah.
No injuries. Actually, back in the day, we had no complaints about injuries. And people around me, they had couple of people, they had serious injuries. Myself, I had like stress fracture on the finger, but it was kind of a little bigger deal than just, oh, my knee hurts or something like that. So these days you hear kids in America, they have asthma, like boy today, and they have injuries and they have all excuses not to do this.
Yeah, you met Dion Krupe, coach we've worked with. Injury of day, IOD. Kids got IOD, injury of day. Andy used the word command. When you think of the command, you think of militant. You're in the Army now.
Yeah.
In the 80s, when I was training tennis teachers in an academic setting, we used one of Ryan Martin's books, Successful Coaching. And it was...
it's a great book.
Self-discovery is one style. Cooperative is another. And the third is command. I was one time training coaches in Ireland, and they had a national champion from each age group, 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s. So four boys, four girls. So one of the coaches raised his hand and said, your command style. I said, well, let me do this. I was working with Aoife Wilson, who I had trained, and I asked her, I said, why don't you take the players in the back and do some footwork drills? Because I didn't want to embarrass the players. I said, okay, I'm going to put the players through simple skills test. They have to, the four quadrants on a tennis court. And I said, this would happen in almost any country. I'm going to feed the ball, just match play tempo, what's appropriate to their level. And so they weren't very, very successful. So I said, for me, self-discovery is out. I can understand cooperation, you know, peer teaching, partner training, working together. But it's almost like Andy said it last week or in these podcasts we've had, it's like you have to stop the bleeding. And it's not a matter of just someone with an efficient stroke. I mean, yeah, it's a bleeding heart. I mean, they're running a lap and they're just showing their pain tolerance. They're just showing that they're
Definitely the difference is physically. So kids, they come here and you help them with forehands and backhands and serves, but most of the time they have to spend on physical training. So they can run, they can catch the ball. So it's no physical skills like biking, ride a bike. So,
well, I know when I was a young coach back in I started in the 70s, but in the 80s, I didn't have people flying in to take tennis lessons and having a coach, someone recommend, you know, go work with them for a week. So when people come, you know, we're just filming their strokes and really initially just work on a technical phase of instruction. Mm-hmm. We do some physical training. It's amazing. We ask kids, well, yeah, I work with a physical trainer twice a week. And, you know, they're running like an 8 minute mile. And I say, well, your physical trainer may be great, but, you know, physical training is just like mental toughness. It's minute by minute. You know, it's not where you're going to work.
Physical leads to mental toughness.
Yeah. I like how you say that, you don't really believe in the, you know, all the discussions on mental emotional training. It's like when Nadal was asked if he used a psychologist when he was very young, he asked someone to translate. And he said, his answer was, no, I don't need a psychologist. I'm not sick.
I don't believe in mental, especially in junior level. So I don't believe it, that they really need mental toughness training.
Dr. James Lair, years ago, I spent time with him. He came every other year, this program we had for coaches. I really liked what he did with 12 different steps. Hmm. What do you do with your eyes? What do you do with your racket? What do you do with your breathing? You know, your pace in between points, your rituals.
16-second cure.
Yeah, that was part of it.
Yeah.
You know, that was, you know, doing basically, you know, many of the 12 steps within the 16 seconds.
Yeah.
But he actually was running a tennis school when he was getting started in Sanibel Island. And it was at, Jimmy Connors was the touring pro. Years ago, resorts would have a touring pro, and they asked Jimmy Connors about mental toughness, and he said, I think it's just a crock. You know, where in other words, you just sit around and talk about it, you know, where get out the skip rope, and it's like Harry Hopman. I'm going to pick out the person who works the hardest on the Davis Cup team, and we'll have a beer at the end of the second practice session, and everybody else is going to go run 10 miles. I do think that Lombardism, fatigue makes cowards of us all. Hmm. You know, and you're running players here. I think it's great, as I mentioned in last week's intro for you, is that my mother used to say it's too bad that there's not male instructors in elementary schools. So I think the American kids are shocked to have a female yelling at them. Tell us about the ratio between male and female coaches in Russia.
Yeah, you said that a lot of
females. I used to be, I would say, 70-80% females, more females. So 70-80% females back in the day. So every place you go, there would be a female coach and more female coaches than men coaches. These days, maybe it's 50-50, but there's still a lot of female coaches.
And why was that?
I don't know. Maybe because women, they have more, you know, more discipline in a way. Like in Russia, it's like a Russian tennis players. I think Russian tennis players, they're definitely more disciplined than men. I'm not talking about everyone, but like some of them, they're too hot-head, and like Murat Safin with his talent, and just sometimes they're a little bit lazy. Molly, maybe that makes her some sense. And I don't know, like teachers, why are the teachers more female at school? So it's the same thing here. And maybe in a way that here that male coaches, you know, they played on tour and this and this. Back in the day, we didn't have, they're all players, they played, but tennis was not a big thing in Soviet Union. So
That's a really good point. Yeah. From a historical standpoint, yeah, when tennis started to boom with Yeltsin, there wasn't a history of having all these Russian.
Yeah. There was Preobrazhenskaya, was like really good player. I think she was like top in nation or something like that, but still the level was not even closer to American tennis back in the day. So maybe they would come and teach as a teacher and find a way.
Yeah. Now, last week I mentioned two players from the South, two sisters from Arkansas, that they're doing very well by American standards. I was looking at some draws. The older sister, she's won 4 matches and she's won 5 sets at Love. Mm. So maybe she should have played up in age group, but nevertheless, that's another subject. But I do yell out to girls, you haven't played anybody whose last name ends in OVA. But no, it's not really just Russia either. It's the Soviet countries. It's Eastern Europe.
Yes, like Bulgarians, they also they go with the same last names and.
But the toughness.
Pliskova, old Czechs, yeah.
With the attitude of the household, parental involvement.
You got a smile on your face.
With so you have 4 children. I know Max played quite a bit at your oldest. Now he's running, but he's been in enough tennis, you know, information teaching is information transfer, that he can actually help teach and coach. He's still a teenage boy, but he actually has quite a bit of tennis knowledge.
He does a little bit, so.
Is there a connection there where one sibling will listen to the other one?
One day it works, one day it doesn't work, so I have to switch. So Max, one day he helps with Timofey, and one day with Stacey. It's like they switch. I switch them with Valentine because you never know. But Stacey has more respect for Max tennis-wise on tennis court. Off the court, she's closer to Valentine.
Relationships, it's always interesting, one sibling to the next. So Stacey just turned 9. He has a twin brother. So she started really with a great base from the beginning.
Yes.
So she had because you came and did an internship when Andy, a group of us were at Tennis Memphis. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had a coach come in tonight from Tennis Memphis, a nonprofit organization to help junior tennis players. But I think the two older brothers. So Natalia has, and her husband Alexei, they have boy, girl, boy, because Stacey is 2 minutes older than her twin brother, correct?
Sure.
All that wisdom but I think the two older brothers, having gone down the path, I think if you study tennis many times, there's exceptions to the rule. I think, you know, like Patrick McEnroe was a really good player, but John McEnroe was first. When it comes down to, it's usually the younger child who benefits because the older two are, you know, beaten down the path, or they're going through learning experiences. I do think a family of 4 today, that's considered a large family, is the more siblings, the more learning.
Yes, for sure.
It's like if one of my brothers messed up, I learned the same lesson, like, oh, I guess I better not do that.
Do you come from a large family yourself?
No, I have just brother. Okay. Yeah, and my husband is the only child, so.
So there goes that idea.
Yep, says.
How about Alexei? Did he play any tennis, or does he play any tennis?
No, Alexei has no sports background, so he swam when he was very young, and then it started at boarding school. He went to boarding school in England,
okay.
So where he did like rugby and like all running, and they had some military sport, like where you have to go camping, like a military. And so I was like,
I do think with, like, say you and your husband to ask your grandparents or your aunts and uncles about what was it like under the Soviet regime, and what was it like to be an athlete at that time? Your husband, who, I'm maybe 20 years old or so, when it comes down to meet a Russian who went to prep school in London, went to Cambridge, then he went to Harvard. It's not your typical behind the Iron Curtain. He got out.
Yeah.
With the discipline. You do think that that's a factor? The Russian kid versus the American kid?
Yes, for sure. So it's family and discipline. So it's Russian parents, like Russian family is different. You know, in Russia, you have grandparents. Okay. And when you have your kids, the grandparents, they usually help with your grandchildren, like with their grandchildren. So they spend time. So it's a little bit different culture. So it's here in America, the grandparents, okay, yeah, they're somewhere, but they're not really helping.
They live in the same household, you're saying?
Sometimes, yes. And of course, like the kids, they take care of the parents, and then the grandparents, they help with the grandchildren. So sometimes it's really, you can't really say where it comes from, but it's a lot of influence come from grandparents to on younger kids. For example, among my four kids, they definitely, one is closer to one grandparent, another one has connection with another one. So it's all, it's not just parents. I would say grandparents, they're always nicer, but they teach the kids some valuables and those discipline more than parents sometimes.
Here's a question that the volumes could be written upon. Why do children and grandparents get along so well? And the answer is they have a common enemy.
Yes.
With in Canada, it's a huge country, but really the bulk of the population lives very close to the U.S. border, because you go so far north in Canada, you're just in the tundra. And as a result, people are closer to the grandparents. The U.S. has become so mobile. I mean, I do think that that's one thing that's unfortunate. Even the immigrants that are working in the U.S. is that the kids are not around their grandparents as much. I think that's a big minus.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And that's big difference. Like nowadays, I spend all summers with grandparents.
You know, like Coco Gauff, my understanding is, this is, I think, amazing. What I've read is that she's homeschooled, or is homeschooled, she's still so young, by her two grandmothers. So wisdom, I always tell junior tennis players, you have no wisdom. You may have wisdom teeth, but you have no wisdom. Wisdom is knowledge with time. We have a young boy here. He's not young. He's taking a gap year. He's going to go to UPenn next year. And he's from the club in Toronto. We interviewed Richard Hernandez and Miron Mann. So he's from that facility. And his first coach was Tessa, Dennis Shapovalov's mother.
Shapovalov.
Say it one more time.
Shapovalov.
Steve, that was amazing.
I said that okay. I'll say vodka.
That was great.
Vodka.
Shtolichnaya.
I have a joke for people that live from Moscow. As I say, I can speak Russian. And I just go, Radio Monte Carlo. Radio Monte Carlo. Because in Moscow, you spend a lot of time in a car going from one place to the next. And
traffic.
I can't understand any Russian, but when they're playing music, I just, in between songs, you hear Radio Monte Carlo. But I think it's interesting that, okay, who's the best tennis player? I really don't like the conversations on GOAT, who's the greatest of all time. But, you know, plural, who are among the best tennis players at this club or that club, this school, that school? You know, it's even like with college programs. You can do some homework. That's one amazing thing about the internet. I'm not totally in favor of the internet. There's a dark side, but when it comes down to, I think it's great that there's so much optimism, but when you stop and just do the homework on how many kids make money And there's so many things to be said about making money in tennis. But you know, how many kids out of a college program become top 300 ATP, WTA? But that's really one amazing thing about Spartak. With Kuznetsova. She's from Spartak.
No, she's not from Spartak. No. She's from St. Petersburg. So she was a very close friend when we were like 13, 14. And she left to Spain, age of 14, around 14. So her parents, they sent her to Spain. So I know her. She's from St. Petersburg, and she used to come with her coach and a group of other girls, lady coach, to the program where I was like outside of Moscow with my coach. And we trained together, and she played tournaments there, and we played some doubles as well. So she always loved doubles and really having a
good... Yeah, she played with Martina Navratilova.
Yes.
I remember when she first started.
Martina, unfortunately, but...
I was hoping that she would get her to go forward more, but coming back to the
Kuznetsova.
Say it one more time.
Kuznetsova. Yes, Kuznetsova actually is one of great examples of great Russian athletes, because she was raised in the family of Olympic cycling family. So her dad is head coach for the Russian Federation cycling team. And mom is Olympic champion, and her brother has Olympic medal. I'm not sure which one, gold or silver, but Olympic medal. And when she was young, I remember her stories. She lived on the base, like a sport base, right? So they really didn't really live in the home. They didn't have an apartment. They have, but they didn't live there. So, and she lived with the team. So she did all workouts. Those like Olympic athletes were doing, you know, preparation every morning. She was up, and that was actually the discipline. So she didn't know other way to.
I've been in that building several times in Moscow, where it's like a beehive, and the bikes. That was the only time I've ever been in a building like that to watch the professional cyclists. But she was there. They have a track at the bottom and courts. Yeah. Courts at the bottom. She won the U.S. Open, and she was the one who said that she was sorry that she had come to the interview late, where I have to clean my strokes.
When she was like 13, she loved hip-hop music and wore like short-cut hair, and there was the black hoodies. Yeah, something like just crazy look, and she was very tomboyish. Great. She was great.
But so she wasn't from Spartak. You met her.
No, she was. Yeah, she was from St. Petersburg, so which is another big city.
When she went to Spain, did she go with her family?
No, family. I think because they have that sports background, and she was never into the cycling sport. Even she was surrounded by those athletes and like her family. I think she was into tennis, and the family, they saw that opportunity. At certain point, they'll. You have less court time in Russia. That's why a lot of, in 90s, the second part of 90s, a lot of tennis players started to leave Russia to find more opportunities in like teenagers to train like America or United States or Spain. Now, these days, a lot of South Europe countries popular, like Croatia or Serbia, people go there as well for training, not just Spain.
Yeah, Murat. Safin, you went to Spain, right?
Yes, in Dinara. I knew Dinara well. And Dinara left too, so they went to the same academy. Svetlana went to Sanchez Casal. So she spent all time there, and like it took her, you know, when you have someone like her coming to academy, it's like easy. She has discipline, she has character, she was so athletic, and it's just a matter of, you know, some hours and matches, and it didn't take her long to become a champion.
Well, that's one interesting point about Floridians, is that the best tennis players are not from Florida. I mean, there's Chrissy Everett, there's Jim Courier, there's great players from Florida, but same where you're living in Southern Cal now, is that players migrate. They find their way to the sunshine. They find their way to more court time, more competition.
Sure.
I mean, you know, these families, obviously, if you have Olympian parents, it's going to help with some genetics.
Sure.
But it just sounds like, okay, you know, the culture of discipline, like you're talking about, hard work. What would your advice be for, you know, you're going down that junior tennis road right now. What are your advice for parents, like as far as?
I would start with if you just you have a kid younger age, so you really want to do more sports. Like tennis is doesn't have to be the only sport, at least till 10, 12, depends on the kids. All kids are different. What I found with my kids and other like students, boys, they get bored pretty quickly with tennis, and tennis is slow at the beginning. It's just a lot of reps. It's
technical.
So technical, yeah. You stand on one place, and so it really doesn't develop athletic ability. So if they can start with something like soccer and I don't know, gymnastics, some north ice skating, so it would be great. And as a beginning of
yeah, play all kinds of sports. It just, you know, I was reading something tonight too, where you know, all the participation trophies or medals and everything's so programmed out that we talk about often. But how do you bring that kind of level of intensity, discipline, character, hard work in today's, I don't know, kind of, I don't want to use the word soft, but it just seems to be a little softer where, like Steve said, more activity, not a sport. You know, let's say they're going to play soccer or some kind of organized sport where it's like, oh yeah, it's all good and just have fun. And everybody gets a medal and everybody gets, you know, everybody's a winner, when that's not really the truth in life and sport. There is a winner and there is a loser a lot of times.
Yeah.
How can a parent, how do you help your kid in those kind of situations? How much do you push them, I guess, or you know what I mean? How do you?
Sure. So it depends on the kid. If the kid is very quiet and it's sometimes hard to push him, so or her. But usually, you really want to make the kid being uncomfortable, not being in their comfort zone. So if you see during the practice, your kid is starting crying, or like, okay, my kids today, so the group of kids here, we ran and it was like, okay, should I call ambulance? So it's just...
there's a few kids out of their
comfort zone. You as a parent, you know your kid well. And if your kid is, you know, tired, exhausted after sport, it's good. So it's good for them. So try to make them uncomfortable. Always I tell parents, tennis parents, if the kids are very soft, you want to bring the group or friend or brother or relative who is really annoying. So to deal with that annoying person, it also helps that, you know, a little toughness younger age too. So if the girl, I have a girl student, like she's 10 and she's such a nice girl, but she can't compete. She gets so stressed out and it's like, she's a little like
my Mavis.
Yes. So, okay, you need someone like who can really drive you crazy. And like a bunch of factors, but I would say running is great. Running is great for all sports. If parents can start running with their kids. I started with my kids like very early when they were like in running strollers, yeah, like joggers, and like start with their bunch of races where you just run like 1 mile and like 5K. Trust me, 5-year-old can run 5K. Yeah. So you just need to train. Yeah. So it's a good motivation usually for the kids when they're prepared for the race. So there is a final goal. For kids, it's important to have a goal. Any training. So when they run like a mile, it's easier than they do like a BIP test, for example, because they don't know how to push themselves. But when you run a mile, you know there is a finish line.
Yeah.
So the time, yeah, there would be like another like few laps and you're done. So running is great for all sports, and it also builds your head. So it's all in your head, and the kids, they learn how to overcome.
Yeah, for our listeners here at Happy Lane, we have 9 acres, and we got 10 bicycles. There's 4/10 of a mile around the property, but we have a 400-meter track in front. They can improve much faster at running than they can at tennis. But they have to run every day. I do think it's a major, major problem in the U.S. where fitness trainers are telling people that tennis is an anaerobic sport, so you don't have to do distance running. Tennis is, it's a marathon of sprints. It's really a breaking point. But when it comes down to it, junior tennis players, again, coming back to college, I do want to say this, is that you want to have kids just sign up, say, I want to be the best I can be. If people were to do what we tell them to do, actually a college scholarship is a consolation prize. If they just were to do everything we were to tell them. They're not starting, late start, bad start. We meet them when they're 16. Their tennis game technically is a total train wreck. But if people just put the hours in, and there's all the hangups on winning and losing, all that interference. But I do think when someone says, I want to get a scholarship, is that try to become the best you can be. I tell people it costs $50 to play pro tennis. In the end, I heard Tracy Austin say one time, pro tennis will find you. Mm-hmm. You won't find pro tennis. Mm-hmm. But the way a wild card runs, where they have to pay the umpires, you could play a wild card for $50 and you're in.
Yeah.
And then the one thing too is that it's a lifelong sport. Kids are, all hung up on their rankings and their ratings. And by the time they're out of the 18s, they're 19 years old. There's just two types of points, WTA and ATP.
Yeah, a lot of these days, I meet a lot of parents, they're obsessed with like, okay, my kid playing for college tennis. But at the end of the day, it's so interesting. They pay so much money for the kid's mm-hmm. tennis with no information. And eventually, the kid is not going to the school. They wanted him to go to the school, her, and they pay money. So they pay money double. So they pay money, a lot of money, for tennis before college, and then they pay money for the college.
Yeah, you definitely put a lot of that money away in savings.
Less than 3% of kids play college tennis. It's not to scare anybody away. And then it's around 85% of players, if they don't make the team, they don't make the lineup as freshmen, they don't make the lineup. Granted, there's always the turnaround stories, but when it comes down to, you said something very important, that they don't get to go to school that they want to. There's almost 5,000 colleges in the U.S., so most tennis players, if their parents invested all this money, they get to a certain level to play at a certain school, but that's not the school they want to go to.
Yes.
Coming back to Mylan, Daniel Coyle's book, I had a Russian father bring his son to me. He was 9 years old, and he said, well, my son's 5 years behind. It was, number one, it was a very, very smart man. He had that mentality. My son is 5 years behind. But if someone has played other sports, you can just tell in their legs. I think that's the big problem. When you talk about running, it's not difficult at all. We do these pre-post videos. Someone can come to us, for just a long weekend. The start of the pandemic, we had a young boy from Wisconsin come, and the parents, they left. They weren't even here one day. I mean, they were here one day. They weren't here overnight to come back the second day. But, so they came in the morning and they just said, we're just listening to the news and we're going to fly home tonight. But they told me that at lunchtime. And I said, when you come back and pick up your son 4 or 5 hours, we'll have made a second video. So we had the pre and we had the post in one day. So it's actually quite easy to say, that doesn't mean that they own it. It's like, no, yeah. This is where your racket needs to be. This is point A, B, C, or checkpoint 1, 2, 3. But getting miles on the legs, that's where people really have to play catch up. But it's the times too where, I think with technology, you always say, well, the young kids are on the telephone. They have too much on screen time. But, I grew up in a family with six. Say my sisters were sophisticated, educated, civil, but the four boys, we were not. And my father had this line, it's not a gymnasium, because we would always be, you know, rainy, lousy day, doing something inside that you should have been doing outside, but the weather was so bad. But I think that's where parents make the mistake of handing the phone to the child or the iPad, and it's just like, boom.
Electronic babysitter.
Yeah, they're just electronic babysitter. They're just totally, totally captivated, and all they're doing is working out their thumbs. And then the legs.
Reality.
No miles on the legs.
I just wanted to go back quickly. I had a conversation today with a tennis parent, and he was talking about, you know, tournament play, and his daughter's 10, and if she should be playing tournaments. And we were talking about her technical game, and I just said, well, she's got to work on some things technically. But I know with Spartak, they kind of had a rule, right? 3 years or so before you were allowed to compete.
Yeah, so we start, usually we would not start competing in the tournaments maybe till 11 or 12. So really, it was not a first priority.
Yeah, just train, get your technique down.
Yeah, I don't remember the hours, so I heard about this, but I've never really, it's just when you were 10 and probably Kournikova was the 9 recruited by Balotieri. Mm-hmm. It's like a different example, but in general, it was like, was not a question.
And the parents were...
They would do what we were told because, you know, it was... the coaches, they were bosses. So not these days, like the parents are the boss. All parents are the bosses.
Yeah, they definitely so switch.
No, it's out of topic. And I want to add on that physical ability for the kids, that point. So for athletic kids, if you take 12-year-old basketball player or like a football player, it's just so much easier to teach them forehands and backhands, tennis, just tennis strokes, than to teach a lot of tennis kids that come these days, because the tennis kids, they have no good technical ability and they have no physical ability. And from my standpoint, physical ability is harder to teach than actually tennis technical ability at younger age.
Yeah. But the one thing where it is easier, it's just the first step out the door. I mean, if you want to do some push-ups, you do one push-up, you start to grow muscle. You don't have to get in the car and drive to a tennis facility. I mean, that's where...
But the problem, you're right. The problem are like electronics and kids, they have iPad, they have laptops, they have phones. And it's okay, it's next generation, it's inevitable. But at the same time, parents, they can... It's also my problem. Like, I have the same issue with some of my kids. And it's always, you always have to negotiate, you have to push them. And in my case, my Russian way works, okay, you're going to do this, and then you get your phone or whatever, your games, or it's just, this is the way at least to survive and make them run. So I make my kids run.
Yeah, no, I think a couple things. One is...
use it as a negotiating tool. Yeah.
With... I tell parents all the time, you really don't need to be your child's buddy until they're an adult. And a lot of times, opposites attract. We talked a little bit about that with brain typing. And the kid knows, you know, that one parent is different than the other parent, and then they become the master manipulator.
Which one am?
Which one are you? I think you're the bad cop, not the good cop.
I'm not a nice, evil person.
Andy and I have done quite a few things where I tease and tell people that, you know, Andy's the bad cop and I'm the good cop. Yeah, Matt Kalora, who's...
That's true, though, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Andy, you're such a nice guy, Andy.
I'm an actor. I just act nice.
Matt Kalora, who was on one of our podcasts, he's out here all the time. His daughter comes out to train with us. Actually, his two boys. His youngest son was out here, and so Cammy is the same age as your daughter, give or take a few months. Taisia, and you had her run 3 miles the other day, and it was just great. So she's Matt's daughter is a big fan of your daughter, but not so much a big fan of you at the moment. Yes.
She'll thank me.
That's true. That's true.
She'll thank me one day.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that you don't want to thank you up front. You know, if they thank you many, many years later. One point to also make about college tennis is that parents are shocked when I tell them that really top college coaches, they're not looking for kids who want to play college tennis. Mm. many kids will get to the college tennis level, be from any country. And we say, you know, and I know people are in a situation where they need a welfare check, so I have to be careful. I don't want to be politically incorrect, but many times what happens is a kid will get a scholarship, and then that's it. That's their goal, and now they're on welfare. Their scholarship, they're really not earning it. And a scholarship, to me, that makes you a pro athlete. If so, it's okay, they're paying for your room and board, they're paying your tuition. So perhaps it's looked upon as being minor league, but you have to get a scholarship. You have to be obviously a very good tennis player. I want to talk a little bit more about your kids' tennis with command style tennis. Taisia, and I'm sure Valentin, your son with a one handed backhand, will listen to this podcast. Excuse me, that Taisia has been more of a soldier. Not perfect, but she's been more like, yes, no, I will do this. Where he's been, you know, like so many teenage boys, the most unmanageable animal of them all. But it's a long road. So I think, say with Taisia, and I'm pushing her buttons, telling her, you know, don't listen to compliments. You know, people, this game's played all over the world. Because with her running, I mean, she's... You should see her run, our listeners. She's a machine. And no, she's, you know, teenage boys are going, whoa, I have to be able to keep up with this certified midget. She's up to my waist. But that there is that thought of early success and too many compliments, too much attention. But I think that's where... it's so important, the five E's of player development: enjoyment, education, experience, exposure, and then your overall environment. So she just turned 9. You know, you and I have talked about it where, you know, that's something I think too about Russian tennis is in the wintertime playing on a slick, hard court that really needs to be resurfaced, and then the summer playing on red clay and having the contrast, having the difference. Something where, like, you're living out in Southern California, a negative to Southern Cal. I know you spent some time in Texas. That's also a hard court environment. I mean, the clubs will have clay, but the tournaments aren't really on clay.
They don't use clay. I was the only one who used the clay in Brookhaven. Coach Dave used it on rainy days.
No, Dave Anderson, who I've worked with so many years, you know, he's helping 25 pros make a living, but he... You know, it's like a tennis city, Brookhaven. You can't really see, like Dave Anderson, he's not Superman, so he can't see when he's on an outdoor court, he can't see what's going on in an indoor court. That's where it's actually, in many ways, it's better where you can see all the players at one time. But no, David was with me years ago in Tyler, Texas, and there was a small club where I had access to the club. They had 2 clay courts. And no one ever used them, like even the adults, because league play is not on clay, and they feel like they're on roller skates.
It's healthier. It's healthier to play on clay.
No, it's much better. But that's something around the world. It's like when Nadal, he won his first Grand Slam on hard court. He won the Australian. It's such a class act. He's in the press conference afterwards. He said, "I would have never said this until I won a Grand Slam on a hard court. But now that I have, we need more clay courts." And then he paused and he said, because when I'm old, I want to be able to play football. You know, because it, you just...
Soccer.
Soccer. Yeah. Yes. You do take such a pounding on the clay. But I do think that's where I have a plan in action. Like, say, your son, Valentin, he's got a one-handed backhand. I think that my son, Connor, said that to Andy's wife when she was learning to hit a one-handed backhand. And why don't you tell the rest of the story?
Yeah, so Connor, we were on the road, I think, somewhere in Europe or somewhere in the world, and came back to Germany and met my wife for the first time, and she said, "Yeah, I play tennis, and you know, I've got a one-handed backhand, or I'm learning a one-handed backhand." And he goes, "Do you want to win?
You're gonna lose."
It's like Henin.
She hits it pretty well, though.
It's like Henin. She was asking. She started from the get-go with a one-hander, and she said, "Well, you lose a lot with. But I think one thing that your son Valentin, he doesn't know it. You know, you do have Valentin, two ears and one mouth, is he's developing instincts to go forward. And, you know, 99, 98, 97% of young kids are not learning instincts to go forward. Mm. Doubles is a crisis. Kids are playing one up, one back. You know, college coaches inherit these kids that don't even know where to stand when they play doubles. And everybody's, you know, really all tight about the UTR improvement, the 2-inch trophy. But to be able to play all over the court, yeah. I have told Valentin that, you know, he's going to be carrying Tacy's bags at Wimbledon.
hitting partner
with Sanchez, Emilio Sanchez, with his sister Arantxa. He was turned down at one point where he wasn't working with the Spanish Tennis Federation. This is a great story, is that they said, well, you can't go with the boys, but if you want to go and be a hitting partner with your sisters, this is when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was ranked 7 in the world. So it's a long, long road. I think money management, you know, that's something too about, you know, tennis at every level. I think too much money is spent on tournaments for young players, traveling all over the country. And that's one thing where the, you know, I'm a big fan of the UTR. I was honored to have Dave Fish a long time ago. You know, I wrote a letter and it's $1,000 a match. It's a $1,500 t-shirt to go to a national tournament. In the nationals, you know, we developed better players when kids had to stay at home. With, you know, Balotelli, 78, 79, there's no such thing as an academy. He put the academy together. The word comes from his background, in the military, you know, discipline. It's like the Midwest. They used to call their sectional tournament the Westerns. And there's so many great players that came out of the Midwest. But now people just think they have to shop and bop. I mean, that's happened in Canadian tennis. And now Canadian tennis, you know, it's not like, well, we have an inferiority complex. We have to go to California. We have to go to Florida. But yeah, it's really just, it's a long road. And when it comes down to money management, I do think that, you know, that would be something to, you know, try to put in place where your daughter, you know, California in the winter and in Europe in the summer with, Papasil. If you read his story where his parents, they just drove right through border control. It's kind of, it's, you know, the story sounds like it was just impulsive, like, well, let's go now, let's just go for it. So shortly after, I mean, he had some older brothers that really helped him out, but they ended up in Vancouver. But shortly after, when the Berlin Wall came down, a lot of people don't know that he spent all his summers in Czechoslovakia. So that right now is, you know, like say in the U.S., Southern California, South Florida, you know, even here in Orlando, hopefully the USTA, it's their national campus is not that old. It's still, you know, in its infancy, that maybe that Orlando would become more of a tennis town. But there's only a few hot spots where there's where the tennis, the players circulate. Now, they don't do that in a place like Russia because of the weather. People go where the sun is. But
we go to Sochi.
Yeah, tell us about the weather there.
Yeah, Sochi is pretty much, you can play in the winter. They have some indoors, so maybe like a month or two, it's a little rough, wet. But we used to go end of April till mid of May for 3 weeks in the spring and 5 weeks in September, October to extend season outdoors to spend more time on clay, red clay, Adler, okay. Adler Tennis Academy. And they were trained. We did fitness on the beach every day, big stones on the beach, and you had to do duck walks. Mm-hmm. And we had to run like two miles one way and 2 miles back. So
Eric Heiden, an Olympic sport, used to duck walk a mile. He's a physician now. He became a world-class cyclist without being a cyclist, but he was a speed skater. He was at Stanford, and McEnroe was his roommate. He spoke on behalf of McEnroe, introducing McEnroe. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he was, you can find it on the internet. He's right up on the podium going, Macron would have made it in my sport. He's too much of a crybaby. But can you imagine? Well, I tell people, you know, we have kids just duck walk from the baseline to the net. And I said, well, we do it more than once, but you're going to have your parents send me an email and you're all of a sudden your knees hurt.
We did actually, I call it Russian fitness. Sometimes I do it with kids. So what we do is we go on track. With these kids, I go like, okay, one third of, we go duck walk and then we do frogs and other drills. But back in the day, we used to go like a lap or two of just ducks and track 400s and then stairs and all those frogs, laps of those.
Yeah. With when it comes down to the management, though, management of time, management of money, you have one child who is on one path and another child on another path. You do where, you know, just by age alone, you know, like where do you take a 14 and under player and where do you take a 10 and under player? But it's just, I think, a matter of trying to make the best of every day. You know, pro tennis, Tracy Austin's right. Pro tennis will find you, but there's always tournaments. And I think a lot of times people get hung up and, you know, I call ITFs for some people, it's idiots traveling foolishly. That's one interesting thing about the UTR is that you can look at an ITF tournament and you can look at the kids' UTR and they really have no business being in the UTR, but people will take your money. Yeah. People will say, oh yeah, take, you know, and entry fees are going way up. But it would be much better if there was, back to the old days, if there was just tennis around the corner, that you could play pickup matches, you go to the park and you could play. But I do think in this country, you know, tennis has become too much of a business and not enough of a sport. It's just cannibalized. Everybody's looking, how can we make money out of this? You know, we're trying to certainly, you know, through our online content, which is free, to try to contribute to the game. I've always done free clinics, but when it comes down to, you know, it's just so expensive to have kids have to travel when they're so young and not be able to just play matches. Yeah. How does that work in Russia? When you were younger, was there ladders? I mean, the coaches set up matches among players?
We didn't play much practice matches. We did play, not much. So usually we would have a lot of, the big difference was these days, American juniors, they play every weekend. Like every weekend is a tournament. Back in the day, what we did, there were some winter tournaments, obviously some indoors, but it was summer that was the season to play more tennis, more tournament tennis. So it was kind of off season to train more in the winter, get ready. Mm-hmm. Few tournaments in the winter time, and then you prepare for summer season. So that's why, like, when we went to Sochi, let's say in April, we were getting ready for that summer season, and we would travel more for tournaments in the summer.
Do they have, do they have club teams, like club competition? Like,
No. Okay. It's not even close to Germany. And yeah. And back in the day, we couldn't really play up in the age. So you could, 1 year, you could play 1 year up. And next year, you had to play down 1 year. So
I think way back when in the States, it was much better when kids just took a private lesson, very much like a young kid learning to play the piano. Take your lesson once a week and you practice. Before, kids would take their private lesson and then they would, okay, let's rally cross courts. They'd get together with a friend. They'd go hit the backboard. They'd feed balls to each other out of a basket. Kids can actually get programmed out. And when kids are signing up for a program, parents don't really realize they're not playing sets. Mm. You know, we have a place that's 5.5 miles from the national campus, and the national campus is an amazing park, 100 tennis courts, public tennis park. And the idea is, okay, you know, it's not really working out right now during the pandemic, but, you know, we train kids and say, okay, go over and play at the public park. And then, you know, if there was just more people playing, I think when the UTR first came out, I think it would have been better if it was, they do have it where it's self-rating. But now you have to pay so much money to play in a UTR event.
$100 Newport Beach for UTR tournament. So it's kind of pricey.
Newport Beach, California. You're going to pay some hefty fees there, gas, everything.
Yeah.
But it's a nice place, that's for sure. And there is a tournament every weekend.
$100.
Well, then, you know, again, send all complaints to Andy Fitzell, greatbasetennis.com. But one of the reasons, in my opinion, maybe it's not an opinion, I've been in this so long, that you hear coaches are saying, go play tournaments, go play tournaments, go play tournaments, because they're taking the weekends off. And years ago, if people did the homework on someone like, say, Chris Everett. What a fantastic tennis player. And I know years ago, I read where she answered this question. Is it'd be great during the school year if you could play one tournament a month. So that's nine. And then in the summertime, if you were to play 2 a month. So, you know, now you're getting up 15 tournaments. But the thing is that years ago, kids played high school tennis and they played practice matches. You know, a place like Holiday Park, where she grew up, I mean, you'd play a ladder match. You know, you'd have to defend, play down, and then play up. And that's just gone away. It's just gone away. But I think if you could play 100 matches a year.
I think, like you said, and it's unfortunate, is because it doesn't make money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think everywhere they make those like a weekend tournaments, not just UST and UTR, just the clubs. They try to make it, okay, Orange Bowl, Red Bowl, Green Bowl. Even in Russia these days, they try to make it, you know, okay, kids are having good time.
Are they using a lot of the Red Ball?
I look at the coaches that teach a few of my friends, so they start using, back in the day, we didn't have, of course, those balls and... But now they started to use those orange, green, red, red, orange, green balls. And the group, so there was always kind of a group lesson. These days, they still tend to have groups. Private lessons, yeah, you can always do a private lesson. But back in the day, we barely have some private lessons. It was like more of a group setting. Mm-hmm. And... Just you work as a team.
Yeah.
You do everything, you know, together.
No, it's interesting. My boys spent quite a bit of time in Sweden, and where they trained, there was no private lessons. So, but I do think that's where in junior tennis, it's really a matter of common sense. You know, how can you get super fit? I can hit tons of balls and hit tons of balls the right way, and then find matches. And you know, and you got to play anybody and everybody. Arguably, the best age group of American tennis players is Jimmy Connors, 1952. Solomon, Dibbs, Stockton, Tanner, Gottfried, and there's another tier of players right behind them that were all great. And Connors said, "Play your age group." You know, I can understand if you're just totally dominating, but Connors is just emphatic. Just play your age group. You know, they didn't say, well, that's where you got to play different ways, play with different styles. And I do think that kids.
I mean, if you were dominating so much, you could, hey, I'm going to serve and volley every single match or come in on the return.
But with, say, for example, Kalamazoo, the men's 16s, or I should say boys 16s and 18s. I'm going to guess it was 1956. Rod Laver won that tournament. That tournament used to be on red clay. It used to be open to foreign players.
Three out of five, right?
The 18s, was every match was 3 out of 5. Yeah. And when it comes down to, you know, in this country, we just made things easier and easier. You know, why would kids go to a national tournament to play a pro set of doubles? Mm-hmm. It's just...
Now they cut it, one set, no ads, like set to six.
Yeah.
No ad scoring. So.
And then I heard they're doing that in college. And granted, college, they have the thought of, you know, trying to get college matches on TV. Is that the dual matches are too long if they're on a, say, on a school day, weekday? But that's just ridiculous. When you hear someone say, we're preparing them for college tennis by having them play one set to six, no ad. I mean, there's four players. I mean, six is not divisible by four. I mean, that's just dumber than dumb. But I, you know, it's like who are making the decisions? And it's, I liked what you said is that, you know, don't make people comfortable. I mean, that's part of the Spanish system is the word suffer.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's a long road, and it's it'll be fun to, it already has been fun to see what you've done with your children in tennis. I think that, once you know a child, you can go back, and I have a memory for that. That's where, adrenaline helps memorization. That when you know, kids certainly will make mistakes, but when it comes down to if someone really wants to be a tennis player, it's not a Disney picture. It's not 90 minutes. And, but no, like say with, your daughter, I mean, she is, like today we were helping her. She's not turning enough on the backhand side. She's not getting the right arms straight fast enough. Looking at her grip, if it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of an inch off, so it's just a matter of getting better. But I do think what I would sum up the difference from my experience, having again spent, and I haven't spent time in Russia per se. I've spent time in Moscow. That'd be like someone coming to the U.S. and they've only been to Miami and say, "Yeah, I really know America," but I know Moscow as far as tennis goes. And when it comes down to somewhere along the line, what's happened is we're way, way too soft. I think a coach from Argentina said it so well, is what the Americans call coaching, we call child's play. And what they call coaching, we would call child abuse. And it's not a picnic. It's not a picnic. When someone says ready, play, you have to put quite a bit together to be a competitive tennis player.
Like you say, Steve, too, a lot of times you use the phrase, serious fun. So it's not that, Thais is having tons of fun out there from what I can see. But she works hard. She's got obviously some discipline coming from you and a little bit of push, but she loves it, And,
yeah,
and
it's passion.
It's serious fun.
It's also obedience, like I said about the two Russian trainers that work for me, come up with one word that defines what you do. For me, I have some Russian mentality. It's like we've got four beat up soccer balls and, I know little or nothing about soccer, but you four right now in and out of those cones, around those goalposts, and I'm just yelling out, go faster, go faster, go faster. And I'm really just a traffic cop. No talking. Go, move.
Yeah.
We have set up where you can play basketball. I do really believe in backboards. I've spent a small fortune on a backboard, almost as much money as you spend on a tennis court.
Yeah.
But, the kids are arguing about basketball, and I know little or nothing about basketball. But I just went over and said, guys, can you imagine if the late, great, so sad, Kobe Bryant was watching you guys play? You guys are so bad. I mean, you're bad at tennis and you're training 5-6 hours a day. I go, you're playing basketball. Just shut up. Be Charlie Hustle.
But when Natalia and I played the other day, it was a different
story. Did you score more than me?
Oh, yeah.
Are you sure?
Oh, yeah. I think I had a triple double actually.
Oh, really?
We have another Russian speaker today. Coach, how do you pronounce it?
Vasily.
He's living in Chicago. He's originally from
Uzbekistan.
How do you say it again?
Uzbekistan.
Yeah, I was once set to go. I had the ticket to go to Kazakhstan, And I think maybe what happened is they looked at some of my videos and said, no, 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 old school. We cancel trip.
I've been to Kazakhstan.
Yeah, there are actually a lot of Russian players. They leave to play for Kazakhstan. They still live in like Moscow.
They bought a lot of Russian players.
Yes, yeah. They pay you. And it's good.
The coach from Chicago, Vasily, right?
Yes, Vasily.
You say it a little better than I do. He said to me today, Tom Gullickson says hello. And I said, you know, I remember doing corporate outings with Tom. But I spent a great deal of time with Tim. Tim worked with Vic Braden at one time. And I was telling this story of these kids. I said, you know, they had a gym right next to where Vic lectured at Coda de Casa. And I just never played basketball. I never missed a lecture. Vic was so easygoing. His coaching staff, they could be on the deck eating orange slices or they could be shooting hoops. He would lecture for 45 minutes. And granted, they knew, you know, quite a bit about Vic's system of instruction. But I played a basketball game more than once, but with Tim Gullickson, he was a very good basketball player. And they just needed me. It was in the evening, everything was done, and it was all right. Winning team is going to be treated by the losing team. We're going to go out afterwards. And I told the kids, I said, you know, I could play decent basketball. All I had to do is be told who I had to be next to. It's like ice hockey, being a defenseman. My job was to make sure the goalie could see the puck. So you just stay between, you know, it's like what the thing is, you hear this in a PE class, you're going to stay so close to that person, you're going to know what flavor gum they're chewing. Yeah. And then it's like you just stay in between, stay as close as you can to that person, just be as annoying as possible. But then if you do get the ball, just pass it as possible. Do not shoot. Do not shoot. But these kids are just constantly arguing. But the thing is, it comes back to the 5 E's. That's another thing, too, with American tennis, is American junior tennis players are not around athletes. They're at a tennis club. So if you're at most tennis facilities in other parts of the world, you're going to see soccer fields. Mm-hmm. You're going to see athletes.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Well, it's been a fun episode talking about tennis in Russia.
Are you going to end by saying a few things in Russian? Is that it?
Well, I was going to introduce the podcast with Dobro, help me out.
Pozhalovat.
Come on, Andy, I've been giving you those personality lessons.
Pozhalovat.
Dobro
pozhalovat.
На podcast. Yeah.
Take it from the top.
Я понимаю.
A little bit louder.
Я понимаю.
По-русски.
По-русски. Yeah. Понимаю по-русски.
Good, Andy.
I did say that last week. I think that Russian is, next to English, Russian is the second tennis language. What is Tatiana's name from Sochi?
Zinina.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time with her and her nephew, Roman. And because Safin went to Spain, he became number one when he was really young in Russia. And so I ended up spending quite a bit of time with her. I think I told a story last week where they didn't go to the Orange Bowl after they had the videos made. Did I say that last week? Help me with a senior moment.
Yeah, you did.
It was the milk and the bologna, and they stayed there all day.
Yeah.
But with help me with my senior moment. You got it?
Safin, number one.
Safin. So Roman, thanks. They send Roman, Gefelnikov, who's from Sochi. He sets them up with a situation in Germany. So what happened is he was very young and he lost his technical base, but he was a Russian living in Germany and learned to speak English. Because when he was with us, he really couldn't speak English very well. But when the movie Miracle on Ice came out, so my son Connor, these guys are like 13 years old. So we go to the movies, we have to go the day it comes out. So we're watching this with a young Russian kid. So my son Connor is giving Roman a Russian hard time. Oh, we kicked your butt. Yeah, we won, we won. And he just said in perfect English, that's why it was miracle.
That is perfect.
That's why it was miracle.
That's why it was miracle. No, it's been great. I mean, what I take from it all, you know, the discipline, the character, those are the biggest things that...
Toughness.
The toughness, the attitude of the household. They just all need to be blonde, blue-eyed.
And smile.
Russian smile.
And
What we should do is get a tape of Natalia coaching. She only has one gear. She only has one pitch, one tone. And I love it.
Just go.
Run.
I love it. And the thing is that the kids...
come on.
Actually, when you came to Tennis Memphis to help us out, and you were obviously someone who played tennis, but you were going to go through an internship to learn how to coach, is the junior tennis players and their parents, I sent them a copy of that that article from Daniel Coyle.
Yeah.
I go, it's coming. She's going to be blowing the whistle. She's going to be yelling. But no, I hope our listeners got something out of this. Thank you very much, Natalia.
Yeah,
thank you. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, yeah, you're more than welcome.
Great to have you here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, you can check us out on the internet, greatbasetennis.com. Check us out on Instagram, at Great Base Tennis. Also, you could find Taisia. She's on Instagram as well. Mom, you are running that account, helping run
Taisia Tennis.
Taisia Tennis.
How do you spell Taisia?
Go ahead. Andy did it well last time.
T-A-I-S-A-S-I-Y. Taisia. Yeah. Tennis.
And tomorrow, Taisia should look very quickly. She shouldn't be on social media, but she should look at our Facebook page tomorrow. It's Jimmy Connors, age 61, hitting against the backboard. And it's Welby Van Horn's backboard.
There you go, Welby's wall.
So those people listen to us. There's lots of connections. We did talk about Welby. But it's great to talk about Russian tennis. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks again.
Thank you.
See you in the next one. Adios. Amigos. Or I should say,
пока. До свидания.
До свидания. All right, до свидания.